From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato. Donald Trump says his immigration raids are a military operation. On LGBT rights, Trump giveth and he taketh away. And we'll discuss how much blame New York City should bear for inflicting Trump on the world. Welcome to a special live from New York, Left, Right, and Center from the Green Space in Manhattan. We are your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Kelly Goff. She's a columnist for The Daily Beast. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
So we are a few hours short of 5 weeks into Donald Trump's presidential term. It's scheduled to last a further 204 weeks, not that I am counting. I realize this runs a bit counter to the hair-on-fire consensus, but my takeaway from this first month and a bit is that the system is actually more or less working, which is to say Trump is subject to the authority of the courts, his agenda and the agenda of Republicans in Congress are susceptible to public opinion, his top staffers can be brought down by scandal. The political and practical barriers to Republican efforts on health care reform and tax reform remain in place. All of which is to say, reality seems to still matter whether or not the president chooses to engage with that reality. This isn't going to be a normal presidency, it's clear, but I'm increasingly confident that so long as some international crisis doesn't go incredibly haywire and kill us all, that our institutions will probably come out of this more or less the way they went into it. So why don't we go down the line, starting with Katrina, and do you agree or disagree with that assessment? How do you feel about Trump a little more than a month in?
Well, first of all, it's great to be in at an evening with no alternative facts. I can feel it.
Don't speak too
soon. Just wait till I get started, Katrina.
No. You know, I think it's too early to tell. What I take heart from is not the stunning pace of cruel orders coming across the screen every day. I take heart from the engagement of people. It's being called a resistance, but it's millions of people in the streets the day after the inauguration, not only in this great city, but around the country, around the world, the airport protests. So I think the system is working in the sense of protest and having an impact, having an effect. At the same time, we see an administration with a calculated strategy to delegitimize the institutions of accountability. And that battle has just started. And where that ends is too early to tell, I think. We've also seen the rampage of a Twitterer, obscure in some ways what's happening with the repeal and the brutalization of public policy in Congress. Now, that may be the normal effect of an election, but the rapid fire dismantling of public policy of regulations, clean air, clean food, banks under regulation, I think these are very important. And, you know, finally, you know, there's a chaos that has been stilled, but it's still a chaotic government. And the idea that this general who's brought on has kind of brought some stability. Well, these, you know, we got a lot of generals who've been architects of wars that haven't ended. You note that there may be a danger of international conflict. I think that's a real and ongoing danger. So I think it's too early to tell. But I take heart from people in the streets, and what I believe we need to do is fight intelligently and strategically and find ways to ensure that our country and its democracy survive. And it's, you know, we're sitting here and it has. I think it's a mistake to go the fascist route. I do. I think.
You mean a mistake to call him a fascist?
I think we want to take our country's history on its own terms. And I think Donald Trump is a homegrown demagogue. And to treat him as such seems more important to me in terms of how to confront and oppose and propose. And I'll end by saying what's imperative is that progressives, liberals, Democrats speak confidently about what they are for, not just about what they are against. That is what the future demands.
Rich, 2 weeks ago during the show, you said that you thought the level of dysfunction in this administration was sort of in the normal range for a new administration finding its sea legs. And then a week ago, you withdrew that assessment after the resignation of Michael Flynn. Oh. Where are you this week? How normal is Trump this week?
we're inching a little bit back towards the normal range. But look, usually your national security advisor lasts at least a month. And Michael Flynn didn't. I think it's important to remember, in one sense, even though it's felt every 6 hours there's some new crisis, yeah. some new outrage, nothing really defining has happened yet. You know, Hurricane Katrina and Bush's second term, that effectively ended his presidency. It created an indelible image of him. And just nothing has happened like that with Trump yet. So I think, to use the Rumsfeldian phrase, there's still a lot of unknown unknowns. You have three chiefs of staff in this White House. You have
only three? Who are you counting?
Well, you got Reince Priebus, who represents the establishment Republican wing. You have Steve Bannon, who represents the populist nationalist wing. And you have Jared Kushner, who represents the family and the non-ideological wing. Now, that seems from the outside not to be a sustainable arrangement. Is it sustainable? Yeah. If it's not sustainable, who's left standing? I would note there's only one of those three who can't be fired. And it's Jared. Then we have, you know, it's kind of the pen and phone type stuff that Obama did is being unraveled fairly rapidly. But the big question is what's going to happen on Capitol Hill, where they didn't line up the way a lot of presidents do. Two or three relatively small things you can pass easily. You can have a signing ceremony, congratulate yourself on your big wins. They've taken on two massive things that are hugely complicated and day by day are proving harder than they thought, repealing and replacing Obamacare, and a major reform of the tax system. And I wouldn't say that the odds are that neither of those things are going to happen. I think maybe the odds are that they will, but every day that passes, it diminishes just a little bit. And then finally, the big question, and this just goes to what an unusual president Donald Trump is, I think a lot depends on how much he wants to succeed as president. And this was a key question in the campaign. How much did he really want to win and rein himself in and have enough discipline actually to get elected? And it turned out the answer was he wanted to win just enough. Right. Just enough. And I suspect that'll be the answer to how much he wants to succeed as president as well, but there's a lot we don't know.
Kelly, we were talking before the show about how this week was the first week that didn't feel totally insane, and we were questioning ourselves as to whether this week really was sort of normal or we've just become so habituated to weirdness that the weird feels normal.
No, and I was about to, that's kind of my general take on what both Katrina and Rich said, which is I just think the bar is so incredibly low. The bar is just that low that this would be hyperbole had I said it about any other candidate or any other president. I think a lot of us are just so grateful we're not in World War III yet. We're laughing, but let's be honest. How many of us, and it's not party specific, I've had plenty of conversations with conservatives who are just saying, we're just hoping we can all make it long enough without actually getting into an unnecessary war with anybody. I mean, when he had the fight with Australia, do you even know anyone who's had an argument with an Aussie? And the fact that he got into an argument with the prime minister within the first 20 minutes. The call ended in 20 minutes, so the fight probably happened 12 minutes in. And so I think for a lot of us, there's just such this sigh of relief that I think it is a combination of we've become normalized to the insanity, so something that's not super insane seems fairly reasonable. And also, there's like a sigh of relief. It's like, okay, he hasn't gotten us into a war yet. It could be worse. And I hate kind of having to have this like flippant thing, but I know I'm not alone. I've heard people who have said, you know, as long as it's just, that's kind of what's, I think, part of what we're reacting to, even though we're, right?
There's a world out there. I mean, I was struck when Trump wanted to do the one China, wanted to step away from the one China policy, remember? And then he kind of, you know, the Chinese leader introduced him to reality. And in China, I forget the Chinese word, but they're now calling Trump paper tiger because he folded. And I think you see the limits of what he can do when he comes up against real power like the Chinese economy and what it could do to us. I will say one thing. I do think that the rolling back of all these rights and regulations, civil rights regulations, you know, it's really been quite brutal. And so I do think that is something we're going to see play out in ugly ways. And I wonder what Rich thinks. I mean, you know, Trump campaigned as a kind of ethno-populist, railing against Goldman Sachs, and his cabinet now looks like an executive retreat for Goldman Sachs. And so where one sees that hypocrisy, I don't think the media at this stage is able to call that out, not yet. But it will grate, and it will be a deeper festering sore at some point on a number of fronts. I think of the transgender issue, just because Trump campaigned, remember, Caitlyn Jenner, and talked about transgender rights. But now he's thrown a sop to the right wing, the social conservatives.
Can I just address the national security briefly? Because I think that's where Trump has been most normalized most quickly. You saw it, his Secretary of Defense goes to Iraq. Trump has spoken for years about stealing Iraq's oil. Right. I mean, this is like his one consistent policy in the Middle East is we're going to steal Iraq's oil. And Mattis lands immediately and said, no, we're not going to take your oil. That's crazy. So you have this kind of unusual situation that you see with Trump and with his surrogates as well, where usually it's the principal who has to rein in, you know, surrogates who go out and say wild things, or he has, you know, a wild-eyed general in his cabinet that he needs to control. This is sort of the opposite, where you have the president who is wild-eyed, and you have the underlings who are more responsible. And I think the choice of H.R. McMaster, if I just address that briefly.
The new national security advisor.
I just know him a little bit. I went on a trip to Iraq with him. He's one of the most impressive people I've ever met, natural leader, hugely courageous. Now, the question always with these generals, it's one thing to have military battlefield courage. It's another thing to have political and bureaucratic courage. Mm-hmm. And that's a question with him, although he did pay a huge price for being a dissenter from the status quo military policy in Iraq that was demonstrably failing. And he was part of turning it around and kind of paid a price for that. But my point is he now has three, you know, at least two and probably three generals who have a lot of moral authority, Mattis, McMaster, Kelly at Homeland Security. Certainly, if Mattis or McMaster quit in the wrong circumstances or were fired in the wrong circumstances, it would rock the administration to its foundations. So I'm more reassured on national security than I thought I would have been coming into this.
I want to pick up, though, on this idea of Trump needing to be reined in by his underlings, because it seems to me that Trump is going to have to make a lot of choices between achieving a policy goal and making a lot of noise that surrounds that policy goal. And so we've seen that, for example, with, you know, Trump repeating the take the oil stuff is unproductive in terms of trying to get cooperation from the Iraqis on what we actually want to do there. You're seeing it right now this week with Rex Tillerson in Mexico trying to smooth over all of the fights that Trump has picked with Mexico. And it seems to me that if Trump's goal is actually to reduce the population of unauthorized immigrants in the United States, to get people who are Mexican citizens who are not authorized to live in the U.S. to live in Mexico, one of the main things you want to do is make living in Mexico appealing to Mexicans. You want to work together with the Mexican government to stabilize the drug violence, to stabilize the economy down there. You do not want to pick a trade war that would put Mexico into recession and actually push the people of Mexico to want to immigrate more to the United States. So it seems to me that strategically, Trump ought to be trying to make nice, but he's inveterately incapable of that. And so I guess the question is, you know, you ask how much does he want to succeed? The question is, does he care more about achieving the set of goals that he laid out in the campaign, or does he care more as being the guy who's seen out there being the man of action making all this noise? I'm afraid that it's the latter, that he mostly wants to make a lot of noise and that he's not interested in follow-up.
Can I actually, though, jump in and say, I actually don't know that that's the question. When you were saying, does he want it and the answer is just enough, that was for the stretch of a campaign. I don't know that he has the capacity to control himself for 4 years. And I think that that is actually perhaps the larger question. And it's not just for 4 years. Running a campaign is running what? Especially a campaign his size, that's a couple hundred people who you're paying. It's not dealing with the government where people actually have the power to say no to you, to vote down your... So I don't know if the capacity is there for him to go the distance.
I think he wants to run a permanent campaign. A permanent campaign. And I think Steve Bannon is comfortable with that. I can't speak for Reince Priebus or Jared Kushner. But that is what he's used to. And it's kind of that constant warlike mode right. that you're always on, that there's always action. And I think you're
and that
right,
there's a
Josh,
win.
That there's a win. There's a win at the end of the day. Win. It's a personal win. It's a kind of for me as opposed for the nation. But I think, you know, there are a lot of moral issues about the immigration question. But I was struck today, you know, former editor at The Nation did a series for WNYC and The Nation called The U.S. of Anxiety, and a lot of it was rooted in Suffolk County. And the police commissioner of Suffolk County was quoted today saying, you know, this fear-mongering, this deportation policy, which is so expansive, is going to hurt my ability to provide public security and safety in the community, because you want to have trust with the very communities that are now targeted in such expensive ways. So I don't think anyone's really thinking that through, but they want the win. They want the target.
On
they
the
want
win,
to expand.
On the win, though, I remember, it, Josh, we were talking about this during the campaign, and there are constant, there is talk, is he pivoting or not pivoting? Mm-hmm. Can he pivot? If he does pivot, can he stay pivoted? You know, on and on about the pivot.
Can
is
he
just,
pivot?
Is he just twirling?
Yeah, he's a dervish.
At one
the
point,
whirling dervish.
Yeah, just saying, you know, he might just, the light bulb might flicker on, and he might figure out the way to win and to wreak vengeance on all these people who've doubted him and criticized him and driven him crazy is to win the election. And he figured that out for about 10 days,
right.
You know, and that's what it took at the end. And you're right, an administration is much longer and much more complicated than this. But I don't discount the possibility he's going to figure out the ultimate way to wreak revenge on everyone and to make all the doubters look like idiots is to win re-election. And eventually that will be, and that sort of dictates doing certain things and doing things in a certain way. On your point on Mexico, Josh, just very, very quickly, I think it's profoundly stupid to hippie punch Mexico over paying for the wall, a wall that's not going to be entirely built, that they're never going to pay for, when there are actually more practical things that you yeah. have leverage to get from them. I mean, it'd be very important to our policy if they actually took back not just Mexicans who are coming over the border, but you know, Hondurans and Guatemalans and folks from illegal immigrants from Central America. But now their national dander is up. You know, and it's not just Americans who feel a sense of national pride and honor and don't like being insulted or pushed around. Other countries feel that way, too.
Absolutely.
And you should be cognizant of it.
Yeah. Well, let us know what you think about Donald Trump's first 34 days on our Facebook page, or you can message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. You are watching or live streaming or listening to a special Left, Right, and Center. We're coming to you from the green space at WNYC in New York City in front of a live audience. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast, is also with us. So let's talk about immigration. Let's talk about the actions that we've seen on immigration in the last couple of weeks. President Trump on Thursday characterized his immigration enforcement efforts as unprecedented, saying, quote, "We're getting really bad dudes out of this country and at a rate that nobody's ever seen before." He also called recent ICE immigration actions a military operation. Now, notably, and this is on the theme we've been discussing, this is roughly the opposite of the message that his Department of Homeland Security has been trying to send, which is that ICE has conducted targeted enforcement operations of this sort for years. Sean Spicer said today that Trump meant military as an adjective to reflect the precision of the operations, not that they are or will be actually conducted by the military. And John Kelly at DHS also reiterated the idea that the military won't actually be used to enforce immigration. So when I look at this, I feel like what Trump wants is he wants unauthorized immigrants to be scared, and he wants Americans to really have this image of him performing this process of kicking unauthorized immigrants out of the country. And I'm worried that we're going to get the worst of both worlds here, which is that we're going to get a lot of performative stuff that causes huge turmoil at home and abroad and is not actually very effective in changing the amount of the unauthorized population in the U.S. or any of the other putative policy goals that Trump has.
I think you're wrong.
Okay.
And let me tell you why. You know, this is part of the whole the bar being set really low. I think the Trump administration started from such a provocative, shell-shocking place with the ban, with, you know, the ban that affected those from primarily Muslim countries. And there was such outrage and engagement. And there's actually a poll that was recently released just a couple days ago by Pew that actually found that for the first time, I think, since they've been tracking, that empathy for all religious faiths have grown significantly in the last couple of years, but most notably among atheists and Muslims, which is something they had not seen before. So I actually think that there's something that's interesting that's happened in terms of his rhetoric on the campaign trail, and I don't know that this poll took into consideration the ban, but my point is where you are kind of seeing a perspective among people who say there is a line too far. And for a lot of Americans who may have been ambivalent, yes, his base was fine with the ban. But for a lot of Americans who may have said, I don't really have an opinion, that was a bridge too far. However, when it comes to adults who are not dreamers who have come to this country illegally, progressives have often been wrong in reading the rest of America who do not identify as progressives on that issue. There are plenty of people who have no problem with people who came here illegally as adults and are not dreamers being deported. I know plenty of people. I have plenty of people in my family who feel that way. I think there, personally, I've written about this, that I'm a strong defender of dreamers. But I think if an adult comes to this country illegally, that is not considered extremist. That is not considered a conservative perspective. Progressives have misread that issue for a long time. So I actually think in the case of Trump and the administration this week, part of the whole normalization thing that we're talking about, Josh, is that that is not seen as wacky, beyond the pale, among a lot of Americans. And I don't just mean Americans who were conservatives. I think that's part of what's going on, is the ban seemed, you know, offensive or religiously targeting someone, and this is seen as, okay, someone came to this country illegally, and finally a president's deporting them.
Katrina, has the left overreached here? Because it seems to me like a lot of the response on the deportation seems to implicitly or even explicitly hold the view that unless you've committed a serious crime that's unrelated to immigration, it is improper and immoral to deport you.
But that's an Obama perspective. Then that's kind of the
point. Well, it's a Hillary Clinton perspective.
Yeah, and a Hillary Clinton perspective.
That it's immoral to...
Right, that you shouldn't deport somebody unless they've committed a crime that's unrelated
to immigration.
That's right,
and I think the expansion now of the categories for deportation may well swing away from what Kelly's saying. I mean, you may see people step back and say, this is too much, you know, the breakup of families. But it's going to be ineffective, I think, in the end. I think the sadness is that history matters and that we have lost the opportunity, largely due to Republicans over the last decade, to have a common sense, comprehensive immigration plan. And it was teed up, it was on the table. And I think what we've seen is because that was pushed away, we haven't been able to deal with this issue. And there's no question that for Trump, and not just for his base, but you saw crossover among people who saw immigration as a proxy issue in the same way they saw trade as a proxy issue. The whole issue of sovereignty and borders is not simply an American issue. It's a global issue at this moment.
Rich, I was surprised this week. Quinnipiac came out with a poll, and the numbers were overall not great for Trump and have shown his approval declining, but they pulled a bunch of issues, and immigration was actually the issue where he pulled worst in terms of whether people thought he's handling the issue well. 58% said they think he's handling immigration badly, and now it's really difficult to poll the immigration issue because the questions are complicated, but that strikes me as an indication that at least in some way he has overreached. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, that may be... kind of in the backwash of the travel ban, which was the rollout was chaotic, and there are a lot of sympathetic people that are held up in airports. I think this is not a radical policy. It's really a restoration of the Bush and Clinton policy. What was radical was Obama's policy, saying that there are certain swaths of illegal immigration that we're just going to ignore. And once basically you're in the interior of the country and you don't commit another crime, we're just going to let you go. And this is saying we're going to target the criminals, but if we raid a house and we find the person we're looking for and we find also other illegal immigrants there, we're not going to ignore them. And there is an exemplary aspect of this. I think just the announcement of this, the furor over it, if nothing actually happened, I think just that in itself would at least discourage border crossings for some period of time, because people don't want to come here to get deported. It's an enormous waste of effort, and being deported is not a pleasant process for anyone. I think ultimately, as we've discussed in the show before, the policy that makes most sense is to have a so-called E-Verify system that's mandatory for employers that makes it harder for them to hire illegal labor. So you diminish the jobs magnet, which is why people come here in the first place. It doesn't involve the trauma of deportations. And if you have a workable system, then eventually you can do some sort of amnesty without the fear of attracting more people into the country. And I would not be shocked, you know, 2019 or, you know, I don't want to shock everyone again to talk about a second term. But if
God
Trump does do, eventually do a Nixon to China on immigration.
Well, but, the
you
problem-
know, for his economic, I mean, you study this far more, but economically it's hard to see how Mr. Trump gets to the growth figures he's talking about if he does this immigration plan as expansively and cruelly as he's suggesting. There are a lot of jobs in this country. I mean, there's been a lot of misinformation, but a lot of jobs Americans aren't going to take. And I think there are parts of this country which rely, as we know from these days without immigrants, on immigrant labor. There's a lot of hypocrisy. On another front, you're going to see a lot of the corporate titans push back, as they have on human rights and LGBTQ rights, on immigrant rights. So there's, you know, it's going to be more than just the left. It's going to be a broader societal pushback.
Well, but that's why I have the fear that I have about getting the worst of both worlds, which is that companies would really hate Rich's idea of mandatory verify, both because it costs money to comply with and because to the extent they depend on low-wage illegal labor, they would no longer be able to do that. And so you can sort of end up with a compromise where Donald Trump does a bunch of showboaty things but doesn't actually interfere too much with the labor market. And then the problem, or a problem with that is, you know, you talk about a Nixon to China situation in 2019. The problem is that depends on a competent government effort to improve immigration enforcement that rolls out and actually works. And I think that's sort of the last kind of thing we can expect from the Donald Trump administration, a successful policy effort that deals with a protracted problem that other more dedicated people have not been able to fix before him, that is so successful that he can then do what was unthinkable before. I don't have faith in the competence of the administration to deliver that.
No.
Kelly?
You're asking me if I have faith in the competence of this administration?
Sorry, you were
is that a
you were posturing like you had something to say.
No, I was just thinking.
Yeah. Well, in that case, why don't you all out there let us know what you think about immigration on our Facebook page.
Nice segue, Josh.
Yes.
That's why he's the host.
That's a cue to go to break.
More than
And then I will actually turn it over to our next panel of guests.
Today on Left, Right, and Center, we'll discuss whether to punch someone in the left, right, or center. Our special guest today is upside-down nerd Milhouse Van Houten.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so that's actually not our panel. That's a shout out we got in a recent episode of The Simpsons. So for those of you who are not here at the Green Space at WNYC and therefore not able to see the video monitors, Milhouse was indeed hanging upside down by his ankle there, which is not how we like to treat our guests. I'm not hanging upside down, but I am Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left still is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine, Rich Lowry of National Review is on the right, and Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast, is also with us. So when Donald Trump ran for president, he promised that he would protect the LGBT community better than Hillary Clinton would. And soon after he took office, he unexpectedly kept in force an Obama executive order that requires government contractors not to discriminate against LGBT employees. But on Wednesday, his Justice and Education departments withdrew a directive that sought to require local school districts to accommodate transgender students by allowing them to use restrooms that align with their gender expression. I say sought to require because the directive had already been tied up in the courts. It was not yet in effect, and now it clearly won't be. Something I found odd about this is actually how similar the way this this transgender bathroom issue, the way it's discussed, and the way immigration has been discussed lately, which is, for Trump, immigration is foremost an issue about crime and what criminal problems immigrants will bring into the United States. Similarly, the discussion around transgender rights has focused so heavily around this alleged concern that people will use trans rights as a cover to commit assaults in bathrooms. It feels in a weird way reflective of the culture war being over, even if the policy fights are not. Trump says Caitlyn Jenner is welcome to use whatever bathroom she wants in Trump Tower, and even opponents of these bathroom access changes seem less than eager to argue the fundamental question of whether trans people deserve to have their gender expression recognized by the government. So I want to start with Rich. What does this say about where social conservatism is right now? Because this pullback on trans rights, it's something that social conservatives wanted and were suing for, but I don't think there's any illusion that Donald Trump is going to really try to bring back the broad social changes they're looking for.
No, I mean, the social rights relationship with Trump is highly transactional. It's based on court nominations, especially to the Supreme Court, and on Trump pretending to be pro-life and acting as if he's pro-life. Those are the two big things that the social right wants. And the signs are that he's going to deliver on those. On this policy, I objected to the procedure of how this was implemented to begin with. It's just we shouldn't have middling bureaucrats in the federal government writing letters that impose policy on the entire country on sensitive social policy. I think this is something that's appropriate for school districts and principals to work out. I'm not sure what the right answer is. I tend to, on the bathroom part of it, and I know there are more permutations of it, I just tend to be a unisex single occupancy bathroom person. I don't see why that doesn't like solve a huge amount of the problem, but I just don't think this is something that we need to have a nationwide ideological war over. If there's going to be an ideological war over it, fight it in the PTAs.
I don't think it's a states' rights issue. I think it's a civil rights issue. I think the protests now will have to go to people fighting and running for PTA and school boards and city councils. What strikes me, though, is The Nation about 2 weeks ago published a leaked draft executive order on discrimination, which related to LGBTQ, among other things, rights. The next day, The New York Times reported that Ivanka and Jared were at war with Sessions, were at war with Bannon, and we are now seeing where that comes out. That full executive order was not implemented. I think they see in the LGBTQ community a weak link that they can throw as a sop to the social conservatives. But I do think that you saw in the response yesterday that LGBTQ rights are now fully part of the gay and lesbian community, the rights, so they will be there will be a real robust protest. But what Rich is saying is that it's very transactional, so that, again, there's an opening to push back. And I don't think, again, this is a left-right issue. I think it's a civil rights issue. Reverend Barber in North Carolina, where we've seen a lot of action and fight over the transgender issue in the bathrooms, has made it into something moral and a civil rights issue, which I think we need to look at.
I think that Rich really nailed it when he said that this is about the president being able to throw a bone to social conservatives, because the fact is Ivanka and Jared, okay, great, they may have gay buddies. The larger issue is that there are plenty of empowered gay white men that Donald Trump does not want to alienate and antagonize,
right,
who have a lot more power than the poor women of color who might be impacted by religious exemption issues, right? So if he can take this bathroom issue that affects, I'm not trying to be dismissive, but it affects a lot fewer people than things like contraception access and some of the other issues. If he can throw social conservatives that bone, I think he's happy to do that so that he doesn't have to antagonize people on things like same-sex marriage, which he's not going to do.
Right.
And how do we know he's not going to do it? Because he said he's not going to do it. Why is he not going to do it? Well, it could just be because he feels so much more morally strongly about that issue, or it could be because there are people in power he's not going to antagonize, his daughter's not going to antagonize, and his son-in-law is not going to antagonize. So I think we have to kind of view all of this through the lens here of reality, which is I kind of see this issue as a bit of a distraction, and that's not to dismiss the kids who are affected by it, but I think it's kind of a, look over here at this issue. Meanwhile, the real crux of the religious exemption, which got almost no coverage, is that literally, if it is to move forward, a pharmacist can say to a woman, oh, you're not married? I don't feel comfortable prescribing birth control to you.
We don't know what an executive order on religious exemptions will say, and we don't know.
But this was the draft.
Right, but then we also don't know which parts of, what Rich said about a bureaucrat being able to do things with a pen, that goes both ways. Trump does not have an unlimited ability to create new legal rights for employees of companies through the issuance of an executive order. So I think we'll see eventually what the scope of that is.
But I thought his statement was telling, though, Josh, about specifically not rolling back the protections for federal contractors. I can't remember how he worded it. And so, again, it's, to me, the classic thing about look over here on what this really small divisive issue that a certain number of activists on both sides sides are focused on and talking on, and let's keep people from distracted from talking about the larger conversation about LGBT rights and whether or not gay employees should have federal protection from being fired, whether they work for federal contractors or not. I think it's partially a political game.
But I think there's a broader thing here, which is that basically in both of these cases, Trump's choice to rescind this order on bathrooms and not to rescind the order on employee discrimination. In each case, I think it's not just what Ivanka and Jared want. It's him taking the path of least political resistance in both cases. If Trump were to seek to keep this order in place, it would not have just been a matter of leaving it in place. He would have been in litigation against states and school districts from conservative jurisdictions who had supported him heavily in the administration. They would have been suing him. He would have been suing them. That would have imposed a lot of costs on him politically with his base, which is not true with the LGBT discrimination, with the employment discrimination stuff. And in a way, it seems similar to me with the evolution that President Obama went through on marriage equality, which is to say that Obama was against marriage equality when it was politically expedient to be opposed.
And then New York Magazine said pretended to be.
Well, yeah. Sure. And then was in favor of it when it was politically expedient to be in favor. And I think it's, Trump faces different incentives because he's a Republican. But I think there's a lesson here for people who care about all sorts of issues that Trump maybe doesn't care that much about personally. Mm. Like, Trump clearly has strong views on trade, and showing him that his trade policy might impose political costs might not convince him. But on most other things, if you can convince Donald Trump that he'll face less crap for being with you than being against you, that's likely to be a good argument for getting
him with
you.
Well, you also have a Supreme Court justice fight coming up. And, he's cut a deal with the social conservatives, and he's going to give them what he needs to give them, but not much more. And he probably learned from the chaotic, incompetent rollout of the Muslim ban that he better cut his losses and not get too caught up with political capital and legal fights.
You think he learned that lesson?
I think he did. I mean, they're going to roll out a new one, which may face the same battles, but I think he learned.
Rich, how are you feeling about appeals court nominations that Trump is going to be making soon and district court nominations? Because there was this deal with social conservatives, and actually it was a remarkably explicit deal, where he literally produced a list of people he might appoint to the Supreme Court and said, I will pick somebody who is on this list. I will not pick anybody else. And it was a way to put him in a box and extract this promise that he would do this specific thing. But that promise doesn't exist for the lower courts. And we've seen, as he has mostly not even tried to appoint people to positions below cabinet level, he's only made about 34 nominations to 550 plus key positions he has to nominate for. He seems very focused on, was this person loyal to me? Did they say nice things about me during the campaign or not? Do you think social conservatives are going to get the deal they're hoping for on those nominations that end up making a lot of policy effectively and create the pool of people who could be appointed to the Supreme Court in the future?
Yeah.
You do.
Because I just don't, it's not something he cares a huge amount about, and the path of least resistance, as you were pointing out earlier, is just going with his party on this. And if he begins appointing a lot of what conservatives would consider wayward judges, they won't get confirmed in the Senate. So it's just going to be easier to appoint conservatives.
Isn't that true for the sub-cabinet jobs, too? Like, the path of least resistance was to appoint Elliot Abrams to be Deputy Secretary of State.
But that is something, that's the core. He cares about trade, immigration, and criticisms of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So if you're Elliot Abrams and you criticized him, and when it looked like Elliot Abrams would be selected as number two, Tillerson wanted him as number two in state, the thinking was, well, I think, don't quote me on this, but the last time that he'd criticized Trump was in May of 2016, so that was okay, because they were counting month by month. But it turned out, no, it wasn't okay. That was too late to be criticizing Donald Trump. So that's something he cares about. It involves his ego and self-image. And look, as a president of the United States, you should, it's okay to want people in your government who are loyal to you. It's just that, especially in staffing the foreign policy positions, it's going to leave you with a very limited pool of people. But on judges, assuming none of these would-be appellate judges have said mean things about Donald Trump, and they're conservatives, they're going to get nominated.
I think the whole idea that Elliot Abrams was an experienced diplomat, foreign policy maker. I mean, he was booted out because Trump wants loyalty. But this guy should have been booted out anyway. He was convicted of perjury in the Iran-Contra. He was a war criminal. I mean, but is that how low the bar is now?
One thing
I think that Donald Trump, I hate to say this because he traffics in insult, not strategy. He's the lousiest messenger. But it is good to see the bipartisan foreign policy establishment, which took us into unending wars, which failed on trade policy, which failed on a whole slew of things. It's discredited. And there are too many of them coming back in. But I don't think that's the worst thing that's happened to this country. I think we could start anew with a better team.
Well, it's a
for the record, Elliot Abrams is not a war criminal.
Yes, he is. Go to El Mazote, where 1,000 civilians were killed about 30 years ago in Salvador, which the New York Times at the time refused to cover, which Elliot Abrams and Otto Reich, appropriately named, covered up with the Office of Truth under Reagan. Don't get me going, but he didn't. This is like the Al Capone situation. I mean, he should have been booted out for that, not because he wrote a column in the Weekly Standard, forgive me, saying Donald Trump was like George McGovern. And
I wasn't meaning to offer Elliot Abrams up for his substantive quality, but just merely as evidence that Trump might not do things that would be convenient to do.
That's true.
Kelly, so as you watch this sort of unfolding with LGBT rights, and I feel like there's a clear pitch here from the Trump people that's basically like, let's have a truce on this. They're looking at France and they're looking at gay support for the National Front and saying, well, you know, if we can bracket LGBT issues, then we can get, you know, gays on the extreme right on all sorts of other things. It feels like this is a pitch that can be offered up to a lot of minority groups. Basically, you know, we won't move your cheese, and don't bother us too much about everything else that might happen. And I don't feel like that sale is being made, but I don't know. It seems to me like that's what they're trying to do.
You mean including my people? They're trying to make that a
I don't mean to ask you to speak for all black people, although I guess I do.
But I will.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, I think we can all agree that of all of the ineffective messaging that's come out of his administration the first couple weeks, I'd say minority messaging is probably going worse than most of the rest, right? Despite Omarosa's valiant attempts to make him palatable. I thought, you know, look, April Ryan is a friend of mine. See, we do all know each other.
This is the reporter.
This is the African-American reporter.
So you control the Congressional Black Caucus through
April.
Yes, I do
too.
Ryan.
He could have asked me.
Can you set up a meeting with me?
Yes.
Congressional Black Caucus?
For those who don't know, but I thought that moment was actually so telling. Like, we're laughing, but the reason it was so telling, just for those who don't know, that April Ryan, who is a White House correspondent, an African-American woman, asked a very fair question about, you know, he's talked a lot about urban communities on the campaign trail and asked the president during his very interesting, entertaining conference whether or not he had plans to meet with the CBC about that agenda. It was very clear he didn't seem to know what the CBC is, which I actually would have loved to see April stick with the acronym and not throw him any rope. But she finally did say the Congressional Black Caucus, and he said, are they friends of yours? And, you know, can you set up a meeting? Because that's the job of a White House correspondent, is to set up meetings with the president with every black person she has in her Rolodex. And so I thought that moment was really telling, right? Because at a surface level, if he just wanted to look like he was going to make a real effort with minority communities and some of the issues that are specific to our community, which there's a real opportunity. I mean, even with DeVos, African Americans actually could have been his allies with her, because the polling shows that African American parents across the board overwhelmingly support charter schools and vouchers and things like that more than other parents. And so there are opportunities, and I've said on more than one occasion on your show, Josh, like, I dream of the election where, you know, I see ads targeting me the way they target soccer moms, and swing state voter ads that feature an African-American woman, and both parties are making a case about why they should get my vote. Never seen it in my lifetime. And I would love to see that, you know, become a reality, because I don't think it benefits my community when one party has a monopoly on the vote, because it means basically both parties have zero incentive to work hard for my vote. And so I would love to see that. I don't hold out hope for an administration that would treat the CBC, not just April, but the CBC, with such a lack of respect, yeah, that would treat an American hero like John Lewis with such a profound lack of respect. And frankly, would see my community with such a lack of respect that they think giving a job of outreach to my community to someone like Omarosa speaks to how much he thinks of my community. But I think the whole thing is really appalling.
On some level, it's a weird Trump thing. Like, I think he thinks that, you know, that Omarosa is a great person to do this, and I don't think it's a particular insult to the black community. I think it's the way he thinks about all sorts of communities.
Let me say this, but he didn't hire Chachi to reach out to Catholics.
Although
he knew he needed
that position open, the Italian outreach.
You know, he needed evangelicals to win. They were a priority, so he put people in place to make it noted that they were a priority. And he didn't have to put enough people in place to say, I want to win every single evangelical vote, so I'm going to pay $1 billion to hire every leading evangelical to advise me. But he hired enough to make it clear he was serious, and my community got Omarosa. And so I think we're starting at a deficit, and I don't see how we gain ground from there.
They do want to work this. They really do. And it doesn't mean they'll actually do it. It doesn't mean they'll do it competently if they try to do it. But you know, this week he went to the African American Museum and read a statement that African American History Museum. And is that? Was I wrong about that, or what was the...
He
needs to do this kind of defensive politics to try to take the edge off, to try to take...
he could start by saying that the Central Park Five actually should have been exonerated.
Thank you.
But the language... And I just have to say... You know,
and he could stop saying...
And I don't mean to interrupt, but the race baiting that he did with our community just got less coverage because he was so busy doing it to so many others.
But wait a minute. But Kelly, I think the race baiting, and it came up with John Lewis, I mean, voter suppression, which was one of the underreported stories in this election, is a form of race baiting. And he continues to say he was elected. I mean, he talks about fraudulent votes. And that has a lot to do with a racialized
view of
voting.
But can I just say this? That's true, Katrina, but here's what I'm more concerned about, is that, you know, we have African-American men who are being shot at the rates they are when they're unarmed by police officers because, as the studies have shown, it's not that white officers are going out and saying, let me go hunt some black men today. They fear them and see them as more inherently dangerous. That's what we've found in research, right? The studies show that. So when the newly elected president of the United States tweets things like, the white homicide rate is due largely to African Americans, that puts people in danger.
Incitement.
And I always remind people whenever people say, well, why do you overreact to someone's tweets about it? Why do you have to react to that? I remind people that the greatest recruitment tool in the history of the Ku Klux Klan, what was it? It was the original film Birth of a Nation. Yeah. It was a fake film. That's what got people to join the Klan in record numbers. So this rhetoric is scary and it's dangerous. And unless he makes a concerted effort to denounce some of that, I don't see how we're even starting from a place of a good faith with my community.
Well, let us know what you think about Trump and outreach of various sorts and various efficacies on our Facebook page, or you can message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. You again are watching, live streaming, or listening to a special Left, Right, and Center. We're taping at the beautiful green space at WNYC with a fantastic live audience here in New York City. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation. On the right, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast, also with us. So we're here in New York, and so I feel like we need to talk a little bit about Donald Trump in New York. Right now, we're in Manhattan, where Donald Trump made his real estate career, and where he got just 10% of the vote in November. When Pauline Kael talked about how she... didn't know anybody who had voted for Nixon. That year, Nixon had taken a third of the vote in Manhattan. So that shows you how much a rejection 10% is this past year. Yet despite that rejection, I can't shake the feeling that we bear a lot of the blame for what happened. Donald Trump's basically been part of the wallpaper here in New York for decades, and his media strategies of distraction and exaggeration that now the whole country's enjoying have been driving tabloid coverage here forever. So Katrina, when you think about Trump in New York, do you feel guilty at all?
No. I was born here, grown. Thank you, Josh. born here, grown up. Now here, I mean, what Kelly just said reminded me, it's very important, the Central Park Five case, defining case in this city's contemporary history, and how Donald Trump behaved is a measure of the man. This is a tabloid city. He is a tabloid outsized candidate. Well, he was. The obliteration of the line between news and entertainment is part of this city, and he played on that through the media nationally. He's also, I don't know if any of you know who Roy Cohn was. Roy Cohn was kind of the underside, the reptile of New York in many ways. He was a character in Tony Kushner's great play, Angels in America, but he was an ugly character, and he was Donald Trump's mentor in some ways. He was his lawyer. He helped with the family's real estate discrimination cases. And he introduced Donald to Roger Stone, who is probably one of the ugliest Republican Nixonian pranksters. And also, the one thing I will say, the upside of Donald Trump, and, you know, I think we have an expression at The Nation, what's bad for the nation is good for the nation. I will never accept that, meaning like when a Donald Trump comes into office, our circulation and everything grows up. But Donald Trump was a journalist's dream. I don't know how many of you knew Wayne Barrett. Mm-hmm. Great journalist, but he wrote several books about Donald Trump. He covered him. He exposed him for what he was. So it's not New York's fault. We did our best. We did New York best. And then it went out into the country, the kind of Trumpian... But Trumpism went out into the country. I will say one thing, though. We should, as a city, not be held accountable for the full cost of security for Trump. No, it's crazy. I mean, it may be, we talked about this, it may be up to $800 million a year. I mean, that's insane. And there should be some equity in terms of federal payment for that.
It is New York's fault. Sorry, New Yorkers. You know, one of the formative events in young Donald Trump's life, his father, of course, a real estate developer, constantly obsessed with getting things in the newspaper and sending out press releases and doing events and ribbon cuttings. And his father was at ribbon cutting for the Verrazano Bridge. And there was a photograph where all the important people and the dignitaries and the politicians, everyone gathered together to take the picture that would be on the front page of all the newspapers the next day. And young Donald Trump was there, and he noticed the architect of the bridge, who I guess was a retiring and modest man, was off to the side and not in the photo. So Trump thought, here's the guy more responsible than any of these people for the construction and the existence of this bridge, and he's being left out and getting no attention. He is a loser, and I will never be like that. And that's the creed he's lived by. And he lived by it very successfully in kind of the toughest media city in the world, and thrived here and managed to stay of interest to people for 30 or 40 years. And then he jumps into the Republican primaries with these media skills and crushes everyone like a bug, you know, because it's like the Broadway actor showing up at the community theater. What's Scott Walker going to do, you know, in comparison with this guy? And, you know, he got very little of the vote in the general election, but in the primary, New York was a strength. New York turned the nomination battle decisively in Trump's favor. My guy, Ted Cruz, got 14% of the vote. And my precinct in Manhattan, you know, the New York Times has this great feature. You can look precinct by precinct and see how many votes. And I looked, and in our precinct, my wife and I accounted for 20% of the Cruz vote. And I thought that was quite high. Then I looked at the precinct south of us. There's one Cruz voter, and I knew who he was. I looked at him. I know that guy.
The thing there, Rich, is New York State was very good to Donald Trump in the primary. The outer boroughs were very good to him. John Kasich won Manhattan.
That's right. Yeah, that's
and
true.
So, Donald Trump lives in Manhattan, built Trump Tower in Manhattan. He's from Queens.
That's why he lost Manhattan, because people know him.
There's a very...
He wants Staten Island.
It's this weird thing to me in that, like, you know, this election is in large part about the growing divide between coastal cities and middle America, and supposedly the great growing social distance. But there's at least some idea of New York that seems to be very appealing to the people who voted for Donald Trump, because he's so New York-y. It's not like he's rejected New York.
I was going to say I'm from Texas, but I figured that would open up a can of worms too politically, so I'm just going to...
Okay. The withering looks you've gotten from Kelly during this program, John.
It's worth it all.
Captured on the live stream.
I do want to note one other thing, though, about Roy Cohn, which is that, you know, Roy Cohn, Trump's mentor, was gay, which is why he's a character in Angels in America. And Donald Trump writes in The Art of the Deal about how impressed he was with Roy Cohn's dedication to not letting people know that he was gay, because Roy Cohn didn't think that was manly and he wanted to be seen as very manly. And it also reminds me of the fact that, like, Donald Trump wanted to have Don King speak for him at the Republican convention.
He had thought Omarosa was bad.
Right. Yeah, but this is a weird thing.
Why is it weird? He's about spectacle.
No, but it's Donald Trump's weird ability to find the worst members of minority groups and befriend them. And then not understand why he can't appeal to that group more broadly. It's like Roy Cohn liked him. Why shouldn't the gays like him? We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Florida referred to what happened in Sweden last night. And what he meant is what he saw on a segment on Fox News about Sweden and immigration the night before, but details. And this caused a huge cataract of mockery in the press, when in reality there are really bad things going on in Sweden, which has had a lot of trouble assimilating a historic wave of asylum seekers that the country has taken in and now to some extent regrets and has closed its borders. And to me, this is a sign that the Trump years are going to be a match between a blunderbuss president, a snotty and hyperventilating press, with often an entirely legitimate issue lurking underneath the sound and fury.
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
So Trump's budget director has announced they want to cut Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which helps fund National Public Radio and National Endowment for the Arts, a set of programs, violence against women programs, to help fight that. These programs cost about $3 billion, which is 1.5% of the $600 billion Pentagon budget, which a report just a year ago noted had $25 billion in waste. I say, look at that Pentagon budget, because all of these programs for the arts, for essential services to keep people engaged with their democracy, are vital. And the Pentagon budget can afford a good swat and a whack. And audit the president, audit the Pentagon.
Kelly Goff.
There's so much divisive news that I think is a little bit of a bummer, and we spend so much time reading and seeing on Twitter and social media and et cetera, so I try to celebrate the good news wherever I can see it. And with that in mind, I want to say that I think a lot of us have felt that in some ways Muslim Americans have been punching bags of the last week, and so of the last couple of weeks. And so I wanted to say that it bears notice that it was Muslim activists who took to social media to launch a fundraising campaign for a Jewish cemetery that was vandalized in St. Louis. And I want to give a shout out not just to them, but what that says about the greatness of our country. Yeah.
For my rant, I just want to note it's been a very chaotic 34 days into the Trump administration, and yet Donald Trump still has not had to deal with a crisis that he didn't create himself, which will not be true through the entirety of his presidency. So while I laid out at the beginning a case for why my blood pressure is lower than it was 5 weeks ago and why the system seems to be holding together, I'm still waiting to see what happens when there's a crisis that comes from somewhere else that requires a president to try to resolve it, that requires a National Security Council that is functional and can de-escalate rather than increase threats in the world. And so once we get through one or two or three of those, and if we get out the other side reasonably okay, then I will start to feel slightly better still. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Left, Right, and Center Live was presented by and recorded at the Green Space at WNYC. I want to thank KCRW's technical and events teams and JC Swadek for mixing this evening's show. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. Tune in Fridays at KCRW 89.9 in LA at 2:30 and 7 p.m. and every Saturday on WNYC AM at 8:20 in New York at 5:30 in the morning if you are up that early. Or you can listen anytime on kcrw.com. That's it for this special live from New York, Left, Right, and Center. Thank you.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.